Good morning. I have talked to about five different people this morning, and all five of the folks I spoke to reported the same thing, and that was they didn't get much sleep last night. So I'm guessing that there were some kind of like wild things like sunspots, or maybe there is an interruption in the magnetic field, or Martians, or something. Anyway. But now we're here, so I appreciate you making the effort to come today, because I don't know about you, but when I come to the Dharma Center, I always feel a little bit better. It's a little bit difficult to get here sometimes, because, you know, like you want to pull the covers over your head and say, okay, this is the snooze alarm, or you just maybe don't feel you have the energy to come down to the Dharma Center. But once you make the effort and you actually get here, it feels better once you get here. So I want to thank everybody who, like me, got up this morning going, eh, but we made it anyway, so I do appreciate that. I also want to thank once again all of the people who volunteer for us and help us. Because it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a village to create a Dharma environment. And so I want to thank everyone who volunteered this morning and who has been volunteering for all of these months as we have been rooming here at Tiferet Israel, coming in and arranging the cushions and arranging the chairs and opening the store and having the volunteer clipboards out. I told someone that somebody should be roving around with a clipboard. There are many clipboards over there. So if you are moved to help us, yes, there he is. He's Justin, who is representing Vanna this morning. Yeah, and he has a pen, and it is sharp, and he will, he will write things down for you. But no, seriously, if you are moved to be a greeter, particularly we need help greeting and welcoming people at the door. And if you remembered feeling new to this place and feeling a little uncertain of what you were getting into coming in the door, you kind of have the feeling of some of the folks who come and visit us for the first time. And if you could be that smiling face they see, and that person who helps to lead them to class or bring them here for meditation, it's a lovely gift that you can give to us and to the whole community. Also want to thank all the volunteers who helped us lead our protector chant this morning. Thank you very much, especially to Marilyn and Julaine, who set up early, and then Sue Ellen, who brought the offerings, and Lama Wangdu, who helped lead the puja this morning. Lama Wangdu has a big test coming up in a couple of weeks, and so I think he's off studying. Is he off studying? Yeah, he's off studying. Okay, all right. I kind of figured that when I didn't see him, I said, okay, yeah, so he's off studying. But I want to take a moment I'm going to ask Marilyn's help. Marilyn, would you mind getting a couple of the texts out of the box? As you know, in our fire, the fire that took our building on the 31st of January in 2016, that fire destroyed, both by fire and by smoke, virtually everything we owned. All of the images you see on our little shrine, most of them, were in the fire and retain and remain smoke damaged. And all of our prayer texts were likewise damaged. And so they smell of smoke now, just as the statues do. And so the wonderful, kind folks at the Namse Bongso bookstore at our home monastery, at KTD Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Monastery in Woodstock, New York, offered us a full set of everything. Peter Van Derzen, the manager of the bookstore, said, "What did you lose? And what do you need?" And we gave him a list, and he provided them all at no cost. And then we had the kind gift of Lama Wangdu and Adriana, and then also the work done by Pema, Jampa Chambi's sister-in-law, and she sewed all of them, with the exception of one, which Adriana, I think you sewed last night, because they were one short. And so she had to sew one of them without a sewing machine last night. So you're going to see one of these that is full of love. Full of love. And you can appreciate every stitch because every stitch is a mantra. Om mani padme hum, right? And so we have, now tell me what this color is, Adriana. This is the Taishi prayer. This is Chenrezig Amitabha, Medicine Buddha, and Green Tara. So now we have a full set of non-smoke damaged puja texts. And so thank you to everybody. Yay. Okay. Before I get into my talk, I'd like to say a couple of things also about KTC Columbus board. Kim is visiting her family today, so is unable to be with us. But next time you see her, give her a hug and shake her hand and thank her because she's just doing an awesome job leading us through the process of rebuilding our center and working with architects. She sat for more than we had a two-hour meeting with Justin and the other. We had the architects and so forth this week, and we're going to have another two-hour meeting tomorrow, right? Yeah, okay, looking over the design and trying to figure out how many bathrooms we need. Yes, we know you need them, so we're going to work that out. But at any rate, those are the kinds of things they've been doing and getting ready for our big luncheon, which you're all invited to attend. You have to RSVP. You have to RSVP so we know how many people are coming. But that will be at 11 o'clock on Sunday the 30th. That's two Sundays. Is that two Sundays from now? Okay, 11 o'clock, two Sundays from now, right upstairs in the upper social hall. We'll celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Columbus KTC. I know that seems unreal because this center is older than a couple of people in this room. And it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me that the center is 40 years old. And when we spoke to Kempo Carter Rinpoche just a couple weeks ago, he was delighted and that we have made our 40th anniversary. And so that's what we'll be celebrating. We'll be showing you a short video that Rinpoche made for you. And then also discussing the plans for the new center. So it's going to be a lovely occasion. We hope you can make it. You can check us out online, or if you're not hardwired, if you don't have internet or whatever, ask any of the board members. We have Justin is here. Who else is here? We have anybody else here from the board today? No, we just have Justin today. Steve Phelan, the treasurer, or Michelle Evans, the assistant director, or Eric Weinberg, the member at large. This is obviously summer travel season, so we're going to have a little bit of in and out as they visit their families. So I just wanted to say a couple things about that. Rinpoche is well, and he sends his love and regards to everyone. And we got to see, I got to see His Holiness Karmapa for about 5 or 10 minutes. When he was visiting KTD, surprise private visit, and we got notified, the lamas who are considered to be on the KTD teaching faculty, we were notified and we went over to meet His Holiness, and we hoped he would give us some advice about how to be teachers, you know. He said, no advice, but he did give us a blessing, and I feel really happy about that, and he did give the Columbus KTC a small, it's maybe 6 inches tall, Buddha statue as a blessing and sort of his presence with us. And I'll have that with me at the luncheon on the 30th if you want to come and visit it. So I'll talk more about that then. But you didn't come to hear the news. You came to hear a Dharma talk. So I'll work on that. We'll start the way I normally do, which is with a small prayer. If you're familiar with the four-line refuge prayer that we recite here, you can chant it out loud. But if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, don't worry. You can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session of Dharma study to the benefit and freedom of all beings. I'll recite this prayer one time. O Sanje Chidang Soji Chonam La Chang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Su Chi Daji Jin Soji Be Sunam Ki Drola Pinchi Sanje Trupasho. O Palin Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi Or Pe De Ten Shala Karin Jembo Gwane Che Sun Te Kusum tugging a trip south to Seoul. Thank you. The Buddhist path is a path from confusion to liberation, from confusion to freedom, from confusion to wisdom. It's a path that everybody is, I guess you could say we're already on this path. We're already on a spiritual path. It's just that we may not totally know it yet. We may have inklings toward a spiritual understanding of life. We may feel that there's more to life than meets the eye. We may think there's more to our mind than meets the eye. We may think that that this world is not just what we can see, but that there's more to it. And we can be uplifted by this world, but also downtrodden by this world. And so I guess you could say we find this world confusing and bewildering at times. And we would like very much to have a greater understanding of this world and our place in it, and how we can make life better, not just for ourselves, but for others as well. And so you could say that this is the spiritual journey, this journey from confusion to wisdom. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, after the conclusion of his 6 years of meditation, achieved a deep understanding, in fact, that was more than just an intellectual understanding. He achieved a liberation of the mind, as it were, that today we call Buddhahood or enlightenment. This deep state of understanding, skill, wisdom, and compassion achieved by the Buddha Shakyamuni was then taught this path to achieve the same goal, was taught to all of the Buddha's disciples, and some of them also achieved awakening during their lifetimes. And then they taught their students, and they taught their students, and they taught their students clear until today. And so the lineage of enlightenment, the lineage of the Buddha, is unbroken. The teachings of the Buddha still help us to manifest our best selves. They help us manifest love, wisdom, and compassion, even now, 2,500 years later. And they still have the power and potential to bring us to Buddhahood and awakening. I like to say that the Buddhist teaching is in some ways egalitarian, in that the Buddha said that both men and women had the equal potential to achieve enlightenment. People at the upper end of society, people at the lower end of society were equal in their potential for awakening, and that discrimination was not only unkind, it was unjust. And the Buddha taught that all beings deserve respect and good treatment. And so the Buddha then, you could say, was a bit of a radical for early century before the Common Era, 600 BC, you know, something like that. He was a bit of a radical in his teachings and his philosophies. But regardless of whether he was viewed as a radical or not, the results were there. His followers achieved a deep state of meditation and wisdom and compassion. So the proof, you could say, was there in front of everyone for all to see. And so then his teachings spread throughout Asia, and over the centuries, they eventually spread to the Western countries and even to the United States of America, where we practice Buddhism today. So at any rate, I wanted to take a moment to talk about the practices and the teachings of the Buddha here at the beginning, in order to talk about the topic, which is clarifying karma and revealing our Buddha nature. Part of the reason that the Buddha could give these teachings of equal potential for men and women, equal potential for people at all ends of the social spectrum, the reason he could give this teaching was because he knew that all beings had Buddha nature. All beings have a mind that has the potential to know itself and to know itself completely. All beings have this. There is not a single being, even the worst being we have ever met, still possesses Buddha nature and has the potential to awaken as a Buddha. And so it is because of this presence of Buddha nature in all beings, that all beings have value and worth, that they don't have to earn. Everyone has value and worth that they don't need to earn because they have Buddha nature. But for many of us, Buddha nature is a beautiful idea that we are not sure we can grasp. We know, we are told we have Buddha nature, and we appreciate hearing it because it makes us feel uplifted when we hear this, that we have Buddha nature. But some folks tell me that when they hear that they have Buddha nature, they instantly feel a little overwhelmed. A little overwhelmed because they fear the work that will need to be done to bring it out. Because I don't know about you, but I look in the mirror and some days I do not see a Buddha. I look in the mirror and I see my own confusion, my own vanity. How's my hair? I see an imperfect person who is bogged down by lots of mental afflictions and difficulties. But this is the function of the teachings of the Buddha, is not just to uplift us with stories of our Buddha nature, which we can uncover if we work hard, but also methods for doing the work. The Buddha didn't just say, here's the destination. He said, here's how you go. Here's how you go. This is the path you take. These are the stages of the path you will go through. These are the landmarks. These are the pitfalls. These are the problems. This is how you go. And so you could say that the Buddha's teaching is in some ways very complete in that it describes not just the destination, but also the path. I feel kind of lucky sometimes, because I run into friends who study different traditions, and some of them don't have a clear path to take. They read books, but they can't grasp methods from the books. They can't grasp A, B, C, the stages of their path. They can't see it. And I think that this is part of the reason why in the Buddhist tradition, teachers are so important, because they can help guide us and help us to avoid those little offshoots of the road that lead, the little cul-de-sacs where we might spend a little time, you know, as we're trying to get where we're going. And so this is the value of having teachers. And what I'm going to be sharing today is some information that I received from my teachers, Kempo Carter Rinpoche, principal among them, about the path and how we undertake the path toward Buddhahood. There are lots of teachings that the Buddha has given, but my favorite one to quote is still the first phrase of the Book of Buddhist Sayings, the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. I love this, because it really states succinctly all of the Buddha's teachings in just a few words. We are what we think. That is, all that we are is experienced by our mind. Our mind is what experiences everything. Our mind is experiencing this room. Our mind is experiencing our world at home. Our mind experiences our world at work. Our mind experiences television and politics, and our mind experiences all of these things, entertainment, you name it. It is our mind that experiences these things. The body takes in information. We see, taste, touch, and so forth, but it is our minds that experience. And therefore, if we want to work with our experience of the world, we need to work with the mind. We need to learn to work with the mind, which is why quiet sitting meditation is the initial practice of the Buddhist tradition. Learning how to sit quietly and allow your attention to come to rest on the breath or upon a visual object, letting your mind come to rest and returning it to that place of rest and attention over and over and over again is a way of beginning to train our minds to see themselves. How would we even have the possibility to see and experience our Buddha nature without at least a slightly tamed, if not fully trained, mind? And this is why meditation is so emphasized. This past weekend, I had the opportunity to listen to Kenpo Lodro Dunyo, who was one of the chief students of the previous Bokar Rinpoche, talk about this. And he said, even if all you can do is sit up in your bed every morning and do 5 minutes of meditation, watching your breath and calling upon your guru, the Buddha, and asking for the blessings of the Buddha, and then doing just a little shamatha right when you awaken, and then you do a little of it right before you go to sleep, he said, you will have done a very good thing for yourself and for the world. Because the more we can tame the mind, the more our mind will be usable and workable for us. I know, I hear people say, I lost my temper. I lost my temper with that person, or I lost my patience with that person. And the reason they lost it is because it is so hard to hold on sometimes when things appear to be coming at you. But until you learn to sit with all of those wild thoughts, I don't know about you, but sometimes I sit and there's a lot of wild stuff going on in my mind. I look kind of placid. Like nothing should be going on, but there can be some pretty interesting things going on up there. Like, why am I thinking about you again? And so forth and so on. If we can learn how to deal with even just these agitating thoughts that we have, how much more could we be potentially? How much more could we do potentially with our minds if we learn to deal with our thoughts? So that's why I like that quotation. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts, we make the world. I know. That's hard to believe sometimes. Okay. While I was at KTD this past month for the 10-day teaching, somebody got up to the microphone and said to Rinpoche, about this political climate we're in. And Rinpoche smiled and said, you know, there is such a thing as group karma, you know. And we all kind of looked at each other and said, me? Was that me? He said, and you all have to learn to work with it. That's what you have to do. You have to learn to work with it and work with each other. That's what you have to do. You have to learn to work with your karma and work with all the people here and work with everything that's going on. You have to figure out how to do it. You have to do it. You have no choice. You have to do it. And so this got me to thinking a little bit about the subject of karma in general. Because if you look at those first two phrases, we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. What this means is that what we habitually think over and over again influences how we see the world. If we see the world as a dangerous place, that's how it is. If we see the world as a place full of possibility and love, that's how it is. And how can we go from one to the other? In a finger snap, based on our habitual tendencies. And so part of what's good about this is that it means we have the potential to change it. Part of the difficulty in hearing Rinpoche said, there's a group karma at work here in the current political climate in your country. He's an American citizen, by the way, and he did vote in the last election. And, you know, so, you know, the whole idea is that we have something to do here. We, in some ways, have created our situation, and we can have an impact on our situation, and we should. We should do our best to take care of ourselves and to take care of each other in spite of everything. And that's, I think, what he was hinting at. But some folks say, well, how does this karma thing work anyhow? We may feel some sympathy for the Buddhist teachings on karma when we first hear about it because it sounds a little bit like justice. You know, what goes around comes around, you know? And we might have a good feeling about that. Unless, of course, we're the one who's receiving the thing that's coming around again. Then if we're receiving the thing that's coming around, we might begin to have a little bit of doubt about karma. But at the very least, when we hear the idea that we create our environment, mental environment, by what we think over and over and over again, we can nod our heads and say, yeah, I can see how I have been a party to how I see the world. I can really see how I've influenced my experience of the world. And what's helpful about this, there's actually hope in the teachings of karma. And that is that if we create karma, we can also change it. I want to say that again. Because we create karma, we can change it. The reason is karma is just part of what the Buddha called relative truth, this relative world of appearances that he called the ocean of samsara, or cyclic existence and suffering. He said it's all relative, it's not Buddhahood, but it can be changed. It's always changing. This world is always changing. Everything is impermanent, including karma. Karma is not an absolute. Karma is not enlightenment. Karma is just a condition, kind of like gravity. We have to obey the laws of gravity. If we don't, we end up on the floor and say, how did I get here? My wonderful father, who passed away a few years ago at the age of 91, he had a little bit of a problem with gravity as he got older. And he said, you know, when I was a kid, I could fall on the ground and nothing would happen. He says, but the older I get, the more difficult it is to get up once I'm down. He said, gravity is no longer my friend. He says, I've decided. Well, the thing is that karma is like gravity in that it's a law. You can't disobey it, but it can be changed. It can be changed. They can create artificial gravity in space. They can lighten gravity on Earth. They can make places on Earth seem like they're the moon, where there's less gravity. And so the idea here is that when we create a habit in our mind, a habit of thinking about people a certain way, or thinking about ourselves a certain way, we might think that we can't change that, but we actually can. And we know this to be true because we change it in a moment in meditation. We're meditating, and that big, ugly thought comes up, and it startles us. And we use our technique. Remember the technique for meditation? Touch and let go, and then return your attention to the breath. And what happens to that thought that we let go of? Poof, it's gone. Unless, of course, we really sort of liked it, and then we'll grab it back again. But, barring that kind of situation, that thought will disappear. And so the momentum of that thought and the karma of that thought begins to fade in that moment. And even things that we think about a lot and create a lot of karma with, like, what shall I think that's negative? I don't like my hair. How about that? I don't like my hair. My hair is ugly. You know, if I think something weird about myself and I keep thinking it, I'm going to actually believe it's true after a while. And then people are going to tell me I have nice hair, and I'm going to say, oh no, my hair is ugly. My hair is terrible. It's just awful, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I can actually begin to think differently about that if I wish to. And in fact, it's probably a good idea to try to change some of these habitual thoughts, especially the negative ones. It's better to try to change those so that we don't dislike ourselves too much. And because if we dislike ourselves too much, we might deny ourselves the things we need to get better. We might say, oh no, I'm unworthy to meditate, which really just keeps us in a stuck situation. So the reason I wanted to talk about karma here at the beginning was to give everybody a little bit of hopefulness. Even if we have terrible habits, even if we have lost our temper more than we have kept our temper, or if people have let us know about our behaviors, like, you do this and you do that, I don't like this and I don't like that, and then we get a little bit hurt feelings and this, that, and the other thing, we can actually begin to make changes in those things just by working with our mind in the moment. We can begin to make a choice, and that's what meditation allows us to do. And it's the same with our karma. You've undoubtedly heard the teachings about karma, that what we do, think, and say makes an impression on us. It makes an impression on us. Some people will call it a karmic impression. Some people will call it a karmic seed. And that karmic seed will eventually come to fruition as an experience. And that experience is going to have the flavor of the karma that produced it. My favorite example is the woman who used to work with me who was a gossip. I tell this story all the time. That was her stock and trade. That's what made her tick. She loved gossip. She lived for having information and dirt on everybody. You know, but what's really interesting is that her big fear was that everybody was gossiping about her. That was the world that she created for herself with her habits. Now, you would think that the negative karma of a gossip would be just impossible to purify, but guess what? It could be done. She could have done it at any time. It would have been difficult, but she could have done it. And how she could do it is by first refraining from the gossip, asking herself, what good is this doing me? What good am I doing for others by doing this? It's just like, it's like leaving a bad taste in your mouth always. Like, what good is that? Where's the benefit there of talking badly about others and enjoying that? And so the idea here is that even though we may have developed some bad habits in our life, those habits can be changed. Those habits can be changed. First, by abstaining from doing those things that cause harm to ourselves and others. And then by gradually using the practices of meditation that the Buddha developed to purify those karmic seeds forever. You can actually remove them because you put them there. You can actually remove them. And let me tell you a little bit about what I've learned on this. There's a lovely book by Trungpa Rinpoche on the 12 links of interdependence. You can download it for free from the internet from Rinpoche.com. Yeah, Rinpoche.com. Somebody did it way back in the dark ages of the internet. Anyway, so this book, The 12 Links of Interdependence, he talks about the four parts of an action. He divides an action into four parts. He says there's the idea, there's the beginning of the action, there's the completion of the action, and there's the satisfaction at having completed the action. I normally use a negative action for this, but you can also use a positive one. My favorite negative action, because I'm weird that way, is swatting a bug. Let's say you see a bug, and you have an instant negative reaction to that bug. And your next thought is, I'm going to kill that bug. I must kill that bug. And so that's the motivation. That's the idea. I must kill the bug. The next thing you do is you get the newspaper. Remember those? And you wad it up, right? And then you raise your arm to strike. That's the beginning of the action. Now, you could quit right there if you wanted to, just as you could have quit when you had the idea. You could have just said, nah, I'm not going to do that. But you started the action. And then eventually, if you're motivated, you will carry out the action and squash the bug. And that's the completion of the action. And then the satisfaction is going, ha ha, got that bug. Okay, so these are the four parts of an action. Each one of these parts creates a stronger karmic impression. Think about this. Just having the idea and then not following up with your body in action, it's not such a big deal. It doesn't make as strong a habit as lifting that newspaper and then swatting and killing the bug and then feeling the satisfaction. You can see how each part of the action, it sharpens that karmic result. So the first thing to do when we're working on trying to purify our karma is to refrain from these negative actions. And then take, I guess what you could say, remedial action on the negativities we've already accumulated. We put them there so we can take them out. The Buddha, knowing how mechanically minded human beings are, he gave a great set of instructions on this. He called it the four powers of purification. Now, I find it interesting that there are four parts to an action and four powers of confession and purification, but I'm not a scholar, so I can't say there's a one-for-one correlation, but I just find it interesting. So there's like four parts to putting it there, and there's four parts for pulling it out. I just thought that was interesting. I like numbers anyway. So anyhow, the four powers of purification are, the first is reliance. You rely on the Buddha or an enlightened being as the witness for your purification. You're relying on the Buddha because the Buddha is without fault and has purified all of his karma and is free from stain. So Buddha is pretty good to rely upon. Imagining that the Buddha is in front of you, the second phase is recalling and regretting your negativity. You can say, well, yesterday was not my best day. You can say, I spoke harshly to that person. I harmed myself by doing X, Y, Z. This happened, that happened. I did this, I did that. And I really regret those. I'm not rejoicing in them anymore. I'm reversing that whole rejoicing thing. I just regret those deeply. Kenpo Karta Rinpoche says we should work on our feelings of regret and make them so strong, he said, as though you'd accidentally taken poison. Like, oh my, that sudden sharp regret. The third of the powers of purification is the power of remedy. It's actually taking a counteraction to the negativity, doing something positive to counteract the negative that you have done. Part of it is the purification practice itself, but you can also use things like the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, the compassion mantra. Each syllable is the purification of one of the six types of mental affliction. Jealousy and pride, attachment, miserliness, ignorance, and hatred. And so all of these are counteracted by the syllables, Om Mani Padme Hum. Or you can use special purification mantras, such as the 100-syllable mantra of the Buddha Vajrasattva, or prayers that have been written by great masters, etc. But you're doing something positive to counterbalance, to put a new karmic seed that's virtuous in the place of the one that you are regretting. And then finally, the fourth of these powers of purification is the power of resolution. You don't just regret the wrong and counteract it. You say, I'm not doing that again. I'm going to try my best to avoid this again because I don't want the momentum of that negative habit to take root. So, four powers of purification. We put the karmic seed in, and with the four powers of purification, we pull it out. And some folks, of course, they might have a feeling of doubt in their mind. They may say, how is that possible exactly? And I know because I was one of those people. I asked Kempo Carter Rinpoche about this. I said, how does it work exactly? And he took his watch off and he shook it at me. He says, you know, you can't take it apart like a watch. He said, you know, it takes place in your mind and you do it. You're the one who does it. You put the seed in, you pull the seed out with the four powers of purification. And I'm like, okay, I get it. In other words, don't overthink this, just do it. The reason I'm bringing all of this up about karma and how our negativities get in the way of the blossoming of our Buddha nature and so forth is because in August, we're going to be doing a special retreat aimed at purification. Every year we do one of these retreats. It's a two-and-a-half-day fasting retreat. It's called the Nyungne, and the Nyungne retreat is going to be the third weekend in August this year, and we're going to be, actually, I'm kind of excited about this. We're doing it at Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Retreat Center. Can you believe it? We're going to be doing Buddhist practice and chanting in a Catholic retreat center. Awesome! Anyway, we'll be doing this the third weekend in August. Lama Ellen is coming from Baltimore, and Lama Tom will be, she and Lama Tom will be leading it. And I promised that I would talk to all of you about the sort of beauty and wonder of this practice because it embodies the four powers of purification. And even if fasting does not interest you, the purification aspect can and should be of interest. And even if you just want to attend the first day and have a half day of fasting and skip the full day of fasting on Sunday, we'll welcome you. We'll welcome you. But if you want to go for it, you certainly can. And I'll be doing more explanations about it as time goes along. So today, my talk today is about the karma, about karma and so forth. And so we're going to be talking a little bit about that this morning. But the next time I talk, which will be in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I'll be talking about the power of mantra practice and the power of relating to our Buddha nature through visualization and mantra. And so I'm going to talk about that as well. So I figured that this would be a good start, would be to talk about what purification is and how we do it and why we do it. And I can say a few things about the Nyungne practice today in case you're not going to be here a few weeks from now. And that is that in the Nyungne practice, we take vows in the morning on the Saturday and on the Sunday. And what we are doing in that time is that we're vowing to not kill, not steal, not lie, commit sexual misconduct, and no taking of intoxicants. We'll also vow not to eat at improper times, meaning after the noon hour. So that there's a half day fasting on the first day, full day fasting on the other day. And also not to wear jewelry and fancy things and perfumes because we're not going to be doing any courting, you know, no courtship behavior during the retreat. And also, we're going to do our best to practice silence and humility. And so we're going to be honorary monks and nuns for a couple of days. And what this is good for is that it shows us what this kind of humble behavior can do for our state of mind. When we're not busy trying to impress people with our speech or do things with our body that are entertaining, when we're not seeking and grasping after entertainment and so forth, our mind can actually quiet down quite a bit. And we can actually experience mantra and visualization practice more thoroughly than we would if we were distracted by entertainments and all kinds of other things like that. So this is the function of doing the retreat, removing ourselves from everyday life and taking some time out to actually focus on our purification and saying, you know, there are beings in this world who never get this chance, and I want to help them also. There are beings in this world who suffer a great deal because of negativity, and they don't have these opportunities to purify. May I help them as well? And so that's a little bit of an introduction to the idea of purification. And when we purify our negativities, what's left is our Buddha nature, which can then shine like the sun when the clouds have been moved away. So anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about today, was to talk a little bit about how we place our karmic habits, how we place them, and then how we remove them through the practice of purification. And then a brief introduction to the idea of the Nyungne practice, but I'll introduce it a little more fully in my next conversation. As I think about it, I will not be here next Sunday, and then the Sunday after that is our special luncheon. So it'll be the first weekend in August that I'm able to talk to you about this again. Meanwhile, you can go online and learn more about the Nyungne there, and if you want to sign up, please do. So we have about 10 minutes. If anybody has questions, the question microphone is at your disposal. And I'll do my best to we can have a discussion on this. So if you have a question, head for the microphone. And we have a customer. Hey, hi there.
Good.
Yeah.
When you make progress in using quiet sitting meditation and the four steps of removing, then to me, I see two possibilities, just me.
Right.
One is kind of being quiet and still forever and not trying to create anything new. And then the other is, okay, we've got rid of the old habit. So I guess what I'm asking is, like, what then? So then, do we create new habits that are focused on positive, you know, karmic imprints, versus not wanting to create anything new? I know it sounds crazy, but
that's exactly what Kempo Rinpoche said when we asked him this question, because he said, "Well, we start out with a lot of bad habits." And so he said the first step for us is to replace our bad habits with good habits. So instead of killing beings, our insects and things, we try to save lives. Instead of lying, we try to be truthful. Instead of speaking harshly, we try to speak gently. And you see what I'm saying? And he says, so we start with a lot of bad habits, and then we try to replace the bad habits with good habits. And this allows our mind to quiet down. Because we're not, I mean, when we do a lot of negative things, our minds are really roiling all the time, like, who did I lie to this time, and what do I have to tell them now? I mean, we see this on the national stage. You know, like, which lie did I tell to who? And, you know, I mean, everybody does this, right? Some people say that that's like the definition of politics is, you know, who did you lie to and about what? So, and I think this goes for everybody, including me. Anyway, so, but I think that we start by replacing the bad habits with good habits, which allows our mind to quiet down so that we can begin to develop habits of love and compassion for others, which is why we teach compassion meditation pretty quickly after we teach quiet sitting meditation, so that people can begin to work with and rehearse the idea of feeling compassion for themselves and feeling compassion for others. And that replaces that negative self-centered habit. And then when you do that, your mind automatically begins to quiet down. And then you have the potential to see through the confusion in your mind and see what mind really is and experience mind as it really is, which is emptiness and lucidity, the idea that you get to see your mind, you get to see your Buddha nature, and that once you see it in a way that is, decisive, that is arriving at the first level of bodhisattva awakening. So taking care of the bad habits, and the way Rinpoche said, he said, first we have a lot of bad habits, then we trade in the bad habits for good habits, but then we meditate and go beyond habit altogether. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's time for one more. There's one more out there. Okay, we got one. Are you a questioner? Are you? Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I'm glad you asked this because I for one can feel overwhelmed personally by all of my habits. I can feel overwhelmed because there's so many. And one of the great masters of the 19th century, Jamgon Kontrol the Great, Tibetan master, he came up with a game plan, which I think makes a lot of sense. He said, work on the stronger mental afflictions first. So that means I have friends who are part of the 12-step program, and they talk about taking a fearless moral inventory of their habits and difficulties and so forth. And once you have identified them, what the things are you struggle with the most, then this is what they said, this is what this 19th century master said. First, identify the ones that trouble you the most, and then really focus your Dharma practice on those first and start to loosen them up, right? And then once you've started making them more workable, then you can work your way down the list. And I think it actually does make sense to do it that way. Kenpo Karcher Rinpoche, in his book, Dharma Paths, he recommends that everybody make up a list. You don't have to show it to anybody. I mean, you know, but of the things you really want to work on. And then he said, there's two benefits to this. Number one, it won't be a mystery to you what you have to work on. But then the other thing is, he says, you won't get so angry when people point them out to you. So that's what I would do. And in the same 19th century manual, it said that when you begin to feel that mental affliction rising within you, anger or whatever the thing you're struggling with the most, the solution is to notice it, notice that it's there. See it as a mental affliction. Don't see it as something good. You see, because a lot of people, when they get angry, they say, oh, goody, now I can put some power into this thing I'm doing. They have a miss. Anger is a bad friend. It makes you think, oh, I'm going to be your buddy. I'm going to help you. It doesn't work like that. It usually makes us stupid and do things we regret. At any rate, he said, recognize your mental affliction for what it is as soon as you can. Okay, that may be 3 weeks down the line, but still, we see that we're feeling it. And then we take counteraction. And the counteraction is to, in the book, the counteraction is to say, this negative habit has never done me any good. It's really only just brought me misery. Therefore, in this moment, I will mentally think of all the people on this planet feeling like I feel right now. All the people who are angry, all the people who are impatient, all the people who are sick of this or that. And I'm going to say, y'all give me your negativity, I'll take it. Well, let me carry that for you. May my anger contain the anger of all beings. And by my working through this moment of anger, which by the time you're halfway through that sentence, it's almost done. Because you're no longer feeding it, right? When you feed it, it gets bigger. When you stop feeding it and start examining it, it begins to lose its power. Almost instantly, it begins to lose power. When you unplug from that story, blah, 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 blah. So then you think, okay, may my anger contain the anger of all beings, and by my working through this moment of anger, may I and all beings be free of it. And may we all become Buddhists, the complete freedom from anger. We may have to repeat this many times. But the more we do it, the more inertial drag we put on that tendency to get angry. You see what I'm saying? It's like we put a weight on it, and it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't flow into anger the way it used to. So I appreciate that. Well, we'll have to stop here for now. I was just reminded that somebody just texted me. Even lamas get texts. That they reminded me that we have we're going to go down to the carpool down to the property, the old KTC property today. If anybody would like to come down and get their picture taken, we're going to have like a little group picture at the vacant lot. This was my wacky idea. I just thought it would be great because it'd be like we're occupying this space and we will be back. And so if we want to get down there somewhere between 1:45 and 1:00, which was my hope, we're going to need to leave now. So let's sit quietly and mentally dedicate the goodness of this session. We dedicate the goodness of this session to all beings who suffer, especially those who are struggling with habits that are harmful to themselves and harmful to others. May beings be free from their negativity. May they come to happiness and freedom, and may they also come to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you to the sound crew. Thank you, sound crew.